nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
I'd like to introduce the first speaker of the next session is Dr. Paul Robinson, who is a professor of biomedical engineering and basic medical sciences here at Purdue and also the School of Veterinary Medicine professor in CytomX. And Paul will be talking about his experiences, I think, and his advice to us on commercialization or not from academia. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Jim. What I'm going to do is actually give you a few slides of my thoughts on this area and then show you an example of failed and then hopefully successful commercialization. And to give you some outline of what I'm going to talk about, I want to give you some perspective that doesn't really come from my experience. I want to give you some of my experience, but I want to give you some experience from a colleague in industry who shared with me a lot of valuable slides. And then I'm going to show you an idea that didn't work and then why it may work, but in a different time scale to when it was. So as a professor, we think a lot. And we try to come up with ideas. And we come up with tons of ideas. And some of those ideas we write grants on. And some of those grants get funded. And some of those ideas coming out of those grants are publishable. And some of those publishable ideas have commercial opportunities. And there may not be a big positive relationship between the number of ideas you have and the number of commercial possibilities there are. In fact, I would argue that it's sort of inversely proportional to the number of ideas, what actually gets commercialized. Now, come back to that same slide, and we now have to identify a commercial entity in which we put those great ideas that we came up with. And when the commercial entity gets hold of that, their interests are going to be in the intellectual property that is contained in that package. And there might be multiple pieces of intellectual property, but there might only be one component of that that ends up with a product. So this is a very long and cumbersome technique, taking many, many years. So in thinking about this, I called one of my colleagues, Terry Federhoff, who's in the Chief Technology Office of Roche. Spend quite a bit of time with Roche these days, and I think I'm actually learning much more than I'm telling them about technology. But Roche, this is one of Terry's next three or four slides are Terry's slides. And he points out that from their perspective, that an innovation occurs when a novel technology is matched with an unmet customer's needs. And his goal is to not only identify the technologies that are out there, but what needs there are that will fill those. And there are two perspectives. There's the customer's perspective, the customer's insight, the customer's needs, and then there's the technology development itself, where you might develop a novel technology, and somewhere in between is this innovation space, and that may or may not lead to commercialization. And the big question from Terry's perspective is, how do you predict the market value of this whiz-bang novel technology that you've just invented? And Terry has a framework he calls the six C's, and I put in the middle here biomarker, because that's what he looks at a lot, and it's got to fit the company, it's got to have the utility of the customer, it's got to have some uniqueness with regard to the competition, It's got to fit in, from a commercial perspective, the market size has got to be appropriate. There's got to be cost involved and capital needs to be available. And there must be some intellectual property. And when you put all that together, you get this a rather nice perspective of how big companies and perhaps small companies look at technology. And this is what they're looking at when they look at what I might take to them or what you might take to a company like Roche. And they have a criteria that they use for determining whether or not the technology is useful or not. And they have a value assessment and a portfolio fit. And that, of course, is specific for their company because they make and sell certain products and it has to fit in all of those components. But this is a very nice overview of how a company is going to evaluate our technology. So Terry asks the question, what is innovation? We're all asked that question. And we have invention here is a novel idea, technology or process. And innovation is a really good invention. So what is that? Well, here's a really good invention. It's invented by John Geddes. And in the 80s, and if you just look at all the text, it's much easier to look at the pictures and find out what this invention really is. So what does this invention do? If you can't really work it out from that picture, let me go through this. Is it a novel technology? Is it a really good invention? It's definitely novel, but is it a really good invention? Maybe not. Now, is the commercialization of a novel technology satisfactory to make this really innovative? No, it's not. So if it's not just innovative because it's successful, what is it? So it's the commercialization of a novel technology that gives the customer new capability. And that's really the criteria that all the good ideas in the world that we have, if they don't give the customer something new, no one's going to be interested in it. It's not going to be commercialized. So let me repeat that. The commercialization of a novel technology that gives the customer new capability. So with that introduction, I'm going to now talk a little bit about a scientific area of high-throughput screening. And I'm going to give you two opposing views. And both these views are very recent views, and they come from two different groups of individuals. And the first one is from a group that has very high impact in the area of high-throughput screening by very advanced and incredibly expensive imaging technologies. So reading their abstract from a paper just a year ago, the term high-content screening has become synonymous with imaging screens using automated microscopes and automated image analysis. That's the definition of high-content screening from one perspective. But if we look at another perspective, a paper just published a month or two ago, in asking the question, how do we come up with new strategies for drug discovery? They identified that they need a radically new paradigm shift in the judicial progression of the screen actives through the hit to probe to lead optimization stages. What they're saying is, what's there isn't good enough. It isn't doing what we need. And they point out that academia has now entered the high-throughput screening arena, which has long been the forte of the pharmaceutical industry. It was started by the pharmaceutical industry, and it's still under control. But we are going to take over, I think. So what he's saying is the strategic partnership between these two divergent institutions is certainly poised to take new lead drug discovery efforts to greater heights. So is this a new opportunity? So what is changing in the world of screening? This is from Anne Carpenter, who heads the Image High Throughput Screening Lab at the Broad Ann is a graduate of our Department of Biology and a really amazingly good scientist and very active person in this field. And she's pointed out that extracting rich information out of a screen in the first pass, primary screen, is now really where it's at. You can't just do these high throughput screens and throw 99% of the data away and hope that you can get somewhere. She also points out that in the academic world, screens of more than 100,000 samples were almost unheard of a few years ago, and now screens of libraries of more than 300,000 compounds are performed. So let's go back to Terry's slide, and I've modified it a little bit, and I've taken away the biomarker and I've replaced it with high throughput screening. And the question is, does this fit? And I think you can see that it does. And if I look at the potential here of finding company fits, we've identified a company here, and the customers are all the drug companies, and they're starting to look at this technology. Is it a value proposition? Yes, it is to them. Is it unique? There is no competition at this time. What's the market share? We don't really know, but we know that these are very, very big companies. Amount of capital? We don't really know that. And have we got intellectual property? That's important, and we do. So where are we going and what can we do? So I just want to read you two quotes from a grant that we recently submitted. And the idea was that we could increase the screening capability to very, very high capabilities. And we could produce at least a 380-well, 4-well plate in just over 2 minutes, which would allow us to screen 90,000 chemicals in an 8-hour day. And that's based on using most of the wells on a 384-well plate. We can increase that by going to 1536 or even higher plates. And one of the things that we promoted in this grant was an idea that within a couple of years, with just some modifications to technology that we already have, in partnership with a commercial partner, of course, that we can do 1 million compounds in 30 hours. And that would be on live cell populations. And if you can do it on a single live cell populations, you can multiplex live cell populations. So using potential new technology, that moves this really into the academic domain, and it gives us some opportunities for systems biology. And that's really what I want to make a fairly strong point about. Just to show you what is out there, I just picked a couple of quotes from the literature where the Medicine for Malaria venture, for example, they are screening 5 million compounds for anti-malaria parasites. And GSK is working on 2 million compounds of their in-house library for Plasmodium as well. So these are big numbers, and I just picked two from many that were out there. So there's a huge opportunity in here. And here's what the space looks like. And this was taken, modified from a paper by Feng a couple of years ago. And the idea here is there's complexity up here on this axis, and there's throughput on this axis. And what you see is that mass spec protein arrays, cDNA microarrays, have complexity over here, but not really high throughput. And over here, you have high throughput, but you don't have complexity. And so what's missing is a place up in here where you have both complexity and high throughput. And that's really where the space is that I'm proposing. And if we look at the imaging systems, all of those imaging systems that I mentioned a little while ago, those high throughput imaging systems that started 10 or 12 years ago and have taken over industry in terms of screening, you can see, yes, we have high complexity here and we have fairly high throughput, and there's a lot of things that we can do up in here in terms of this type of analysis. But if we add other technologies to this, another screening technology, then there's a very good chance that we can increase the throughput and increase the complexity and therefore the capacity to screen molecules for drug discovery. So I mentioned a failed attempt. In 1991, we published two papers, and those two papers got almost no press. People looked at them and said, what is the point of doing this? Because what we pointed out was that you could compact data in such a way that you could do vast amounts of analysis. And we came up with another way of analyzing data using time in integral interval gating. Here was the problem. It was a good idea, but you couldn't run many samples. So what was the point? It would take 3 weeks to run enough samples so you could analyze it in an hour or two. But people wouldn't do that. So the concept was a good concept. It was a great idea. We never thought of patenting any of this work in those days. We published it and we forgot about it. And the idea, though, in this sort of analysis is that you have some complex system. You break it up because you have no choice. And then you run all of these components individually, and then you have this very large compilation of data. You try to put that back together again. And if you could avoid some parts of that, it would be advantageous. And so the concept of high throughput flow tries to do that. It tries to take the original sample. It tries to map that original sample into something that at least replicates the structure of the assay system that you're trying to look at as a single entity. And then the goal is to pull out those data as quickly as possible. And what we did was we built some hardware to do this, and this is a fully automated system. And you can see over on the right-hand side an automated incubator which delivers plates to the biomech. First of all, they have taken from the biomech and produced, put in the incubator, back to the biomech, add more reagents. Across here to this robot, which is hooked up to a flow cytometer, and then they automatically run. So this means that you can run a large number of samples in a very short period of time. So why would you do this, and how could you develop screens that would change the way perhaps high throughput screening is done? The real key here is looking at live cells and looking at them very, very quickly. And the problem with doing live cell screens is that if you need to do a live cell screen where the cells can't be more than 5 or 6 hours old at the time of screening, you either have to have a huge number of systems if you want to do them quickly, or you have to continuously produce cells in a way that they're identical in nature every time you produce them. But cells cycle, and they get older and older, and more cells cycle, and they change their structure and the products they produce and the molecules and enzymes. So that makes it really, really difficult. So the concept is to try to develop systems that can be run together in a systems approach. And so here's an example where multiple assays can be run on a single or even multiple populations at the same time using lots of drugs. And this is just a fairly simple assay looking at functional probes, mainly in the redox area, and membrane potential. So that's the overview of the sorts of assay. Now, you can spend a lot of time, like several days, to analyze the data if you can run it, or you can come up with a different model. Here's the two models that are available for data processing. And the first model here is the typical standard model where you take lots of different components, you pull the components out one at a time, and you find those individual features, and you provide your analysis. And then the alternative is a process whereby you take a very large data set, you make it into a very complex matrix, you pull out features, and then you can reduce data very quickly. Now, if you could do this in a fully automated way, that would be advantageous. And it would be better, faster, and cheaper. So this is a job that does not require human intervention. And that becomes very important when you have a huge amount of data. You want to analyze the data in a reproducible fashion. And so here's an example of an IC50 curve that can be produced fully automatically using a whole series of options like quadratic form, earth movers distance, a whole stack of different methods that I'm going to show you. Now, the whole idea of this would be fine if we were just to place this in the hands of informatics experts, which is pretty much what we do. If you go to drug companies and you look at their screening operations, they often have more people in the informatics group than they actually have in the screening group, because the analysis of the data is very complicated. So we decided that what we needed to do was to bring that to the biology space, where the average biologist could actually create extremely complex analytical tools in a MATLAB-type environment. And so that is really the key process that we developed. And in this process, that the entire data space gets entered into a system with the knowledge that you know precisely what it is you're looking for. You enter those questions into the system, as I showed you on this slide. So you create this space. I want these cells under these conditions with these drugs, and I want these results. And then you can go through and produce the results almost immediately. And so an analysis like this on a 384-well plate, once you create your protocol, takes about 30 seconds. So this means you have instantaneous results to your assays. And they can be extremely complex data sets. So in this, for example, this is opening up the options button right here would give you this. And in here, you can see that you can select Euclidean, Kolmogorov-Smirnov, Kullback-Leibler divergence, or there's earth movers, there's all sorts of other things that can be added in there. Even if you don't entirely understand the math involved in doing that, the system is designed to try to avoid at least you making bad mistakes. And the idea is to make it simple. So here's an example of three functional assays, 32 drugs, 96 curves, all produced with a single click of a mouse. Now, that is now the pathway, what we call a logic tree, that produces that. And this logic tree lets you go through what is a really logical process. I want these cells, I want these parameters. These are the Boolean operators that you would link them with. Here are my drug sets, which tell me all the drugs that are involved. And here is what I want to do with them. I want a IC50 plot, or I want some other process. And here is an example, again, of that same data set. Here's the raw data set. And that raw data set has 384 wells there, each identified, and this is a very low resolution picture of very high resolution data, and here are the resulting curves from that. And if you go back to what I showed you from 1991, you'll see that here's the time interval gating process here, and here's the complex single file analysis. So, unfortunately, 10 years ago, somebody else submitted a patent on this exact technology. Any company that tries to commercialize that will least have a chance of going back and looking at the literature. So what it says is don't publish things in journals that people don't read. I think that's one of the messages so journal publication becomes very, very important when you publish your ideas if you're not going to commercialize them yourselves. I want to show you a second application, so not just for drug screening for looking for compounds, but in actual screening of patients' leukocytes for therapy. And here's an example from a group that is currently screening lymphocytes, and their goal is to find activated activation molecules, phosphorylation sites, in fact, that have changed, in this case, pstat3 and pstat1, and they have to find them on many subsets of patient lymphocytes. And to do an average assay requires about 300 tubes of sample. And the time to analyze this is a couple of days, 2 to 3 days, to do that data reduction. So we took that data set, and here's what that data set looks like if you create a logic tree. And this is a logic tree where the answer is first. What is the answer? The answer is, what are the pstat activation markers on these cells? And we're looking for those on each different cell population. So that's the answer, and that therefore drives the rest of the equation, which now identifies the cell populations, and through a series of classifications, looking for monocytes, looking for B cells, looking for T cells, and subsets within those, we can now, and then applying the different drug concentrations for those patient cells, over here we have the results, here again in a single plot, and here in a matter of about 4 minutes, because this is about 5 million cells, 7 colors, 9 parameters, and many, many complex analyses. So the computer really churns away for about 4 minutes to produce these curves. But here they are. So what we have now is an ability to really apply very complex analyses. Now, the next step for this is to do automated analysis on this. It's a little bit more complicated because of the very complex gating strategy that you need to separate out all your T cells, B cells, monocytes, etc. So, coming back to that earlier slide, where I pointed out that what we need, if we're going to provide a technology that's useful, it has to satisfy a specific need in the marketplace. And this space up in the top corner here has been vacant for a long time. And I think that what we've developed now is a technology that really can transform the space up there, because it's high parameter. We are at the moment up to 9 parameters in doing these analyses, but there is no reason why this can't expand. And with Scott Tanner's development of the CyTOF technology, where he's now applying 30 markers with this technology, then we believe that we can apply that in exactly the same space. So in conclusion, I think it's best to invent technologies at the right time, because they have to be appropriate for the needs of the customer. And it's very clear that intellectually exciting ideas don't necessarily excite the market prospects. The real key here is that systems biology is the sort of big picture of biology. But you need big picture ways of asking questions. And this ability now to take live cells and under extreme speed produce results and run assays, I think is really quite revolutionary, because the old days of running a sample or two or 20 or 50 or even 100 a day are gone, and we can run 20,000 or maybe with some technology that's now under development, a million compounds in 30 hours. So that's a stretch, but that's where we're probably going to be in about 2 years' time. I think that it's transforming the world of high-throughput screening, where screening has always been on attached cells. And we've recently shown that we can take attached cells and run them through the flow system and do the same analysis as that we've been doing before. And this, I think, technology is a great example of something that ideas that came up many, many years ago, but completely failed. And with time and with technology development and other people's insight into ideas, that this technology, I think, is going to be transformational. So with that, I'd like to acknowledge the people who've been key in this project, and I've highlighted most of them in a lighter color here. Valeri Pitserkin writes all the software. Maria Tsiper and Larissa Abramova are very fundamental in terms of the high-throughput automation. Two undergraduate students worked on this project, and we'll have their names on papers in this work, both biomedical engineering students. And the two key professors that are working on this with me are Bartek River and Joe Davison. And most of the work is really done by the technicians in the lab. Thank you very much for your attention.
High screening, whatever you call it, is
you want
great,
to fix that for the next one.
Great talk.
The reality is, despite all these advances in high throughput screening, the number of drugs coming to the market decreasing every year. So what is wrong with the pharmaceutical industry now?
That's a really good question. I think the high throughput screening, I think the pharmaceutical industry goes through phases about every 10 or 15 years. They've gone through the phase of high throughput screening with the tools that they've had available, and they've really struggled. I think that some new tools that allow you to, in a shorter period of time, in a more complex environment, that is perhaps more, realistic in terms of, cell function, is really where we're going. And most screening has looked at single functions in the hundreds of thousands of screens, looking at a single function on a single molecule at a time. And that doesn't seem to me to be how biology really works. And I think that's the real problem. Okay, thank you. Thank you.